Part 5 of 6 from set number 1009, a supplement to Jung's 7 Sermons to the Dead, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Abraxas Amulets in Image and Reality. Illustrated with images viewable with your web browser. See the related HTML web style pages files.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, this is a little two-part program series that we are conducting this Friday and the following Friday. And this Friday is primarily devoted to the showing of a number of original Gnostic talismanic gems in photographic form. And the next week, a week from tonight, I will have just a talk without the pictures on the figure of Abraxas, about which I'll be able to see only very little tonight. And with that, I believe we can proceed with this evening's program. The reason for this program, or let's say the circumstances which made it possible, have to do with the fact that we have a friend in a distant state who wishes to remain anonymous, who has loaned us from his own collection, or I think he pretty much loaned us his entire collection of Gnostic gems for our inspection. And they consist of 4 magnificent ancient pieces, the family of 4, which you see there. In addition to these 4, there is also another piece which the same generous friend, whom we have never met personally, had presented me with as a gift a number of years ago, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 years ago, and which is in a special receptacle, but which will also be shown. Plus, we will have fairly well-known piece of a Gnostic gem which belonged to the late Mr. Manly Palmer Hall, and in fact it's the one which for several decades he has worn as his ring, always. We will see that also. But now, by way of introducing this, I want to say a few words about Gnostic talismanic gems, and then we will look at the various gems themselves, and to the extent that I can, I will try to explain what is on them. Gnostic stones with characteristically Gnostic designs and inscriptions have been discovered in Egypt and other places of the Mideast for quite a long time. But for the most part, people didn't know what to do with them, except perhaps to pick them up and put them in their collections, since they considered them more or less valuable antiques. Their study and their explication had to wait quite a long time. In fact, it was in 1864 that there appeared the first book in England which dealt in a scholarly and sympathetic and understanding manner with the Gnostic talismanic gems. It was a book entitled somewhat ironically, The Gnostics and Their Remains. I always felt it should have been written by an undertaker. But by remains, they meant not mummified bodies of Gnostics, but rather the talismanic gems. The author of the work, C.W. King, a scholar of Trinity College, Cambridge, was an open-minded scholar of what was then known of Gnosticism, which wasn't all that much. And more importantly, he was a devout student of ancient gemstones, not only of the Gnostic variety, because he had also written an other book entitled Antique Gems and Rings, in which he wrote primarily about the nature and the use of talismanic gems in the Roman Empire. In his book, which I mentioned earlier, The Gnostics and Their Remains, he wrote extensively about many talismanic gemstones of the Gnostics. And King was really the first one to call attention to these so-called remains of the Gnostics, and to do so in a sympathetic and informed manner. Because he tried to, and he did his best to explain the teachings, the symbolism, and the mythology of the Gnostics in order to explain the arcane symbols of the designs. And so his book was really not only a book concerning the stones, but really also concerning Gnosticism. It was a very pioneering work. He might be considered then really as the first representative of Gnostic archaeology. The only other work comparable in that regard having been written by the French scholar Chifflet, published in 1617. So the 1617, from 1617 to 1864, there was nothing written on this subject at all. Now, since King's book, there has been an increasing interest in these gems, and today, of course, with the aid of the now available Nag Hammadi Gnostic books and the resurgence of scholarship regarding Gnosticism, we have much more useful information on the subject than before. Now, a few key elements need to be considered. First, what is a talisman or an amulet? Definition of a talisman, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is an object engraven with figures or characters to which are attributed the occult powers of planetary influences and celestial configurations under which it is made. Not a very helpful definition for our purposes. Term talisman originates in the Greek word telesma, which very vaguely means a consecrated object. The other related word comes from the Latin amuletum, an amulet, which is defined as something worn about a person as a charm or a preventive against difficulties, against evil, mischief, disease, hexes, witchcraft, and so forth. Now, both of these definitions for our purposes are rather inadequate. I would suggest that there are really three uses of talismanic and amuletic objects. The first is the one that these dictionaries capitalize on, namely protection against evil. Whenever you see a movie about Dracula, or even about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of my absolute all-time favorites, and so forth, then of course you will see that in the objects used by the Vampire Slayer and others are things that will keep vampires away, primarily crosses and crucifixes. But of course, while that is not an untrue recognition, protective objects of various kinds exist in all traditions, probably one of the oldest being in the Jewish tradition, the amulets against Lilith. Because Lilith, the legendary first wife of Adam, who became the queen of the night demons, threatens small children, and she's sort of an original lady vampire, and so over the cradles certain specific amulets would be hung to keep Lilith away. Also, within the magical tradition, we have the protective pentagram of Solomon, which is worn by a lot of people today, some of whom perhaps don't even know why they are wearing it, but it just looks okay. So there is definitely the protective element. But there is also, there are two more. And I think the second of these is probably more relevant to our purposes, because I think amulets and talismans exist in order to link the individual by way of a symbol with the power symbolized. And here, of course, the whole issue comes up of what is a symbol. And we certainly don't have the time to explicate that to any major extent. But we need to remember that the symbol is not a mere sign, but that it is a cipher to a mystery. It is a sort of an opener of the way, a key whereby one enters a deeper reality. And indeed, it has been recognized as such by modern depth psychology, especially by the psychology of C.G. Jung. So when an amuletic or talismanic object then has such a symbolic value, then it represents a psycho-spiritual link with a non-material reality. And this is not... I think anything so far-fetched, because certainly it is in that manner that innumerable people use the cross or the crucifix of Christ, that the Buddhists use representations of the Lord Buddha or of the Dharma Chakra and other forms which are called rupas, because the rupa represents the arupa. The form represents the formless reality. Similarly, the mezuzah, the chai, which is the word for life in Hebrew, the medals of the Blessed Virgin, of the saints, all of these exist for the purpose of linking the person with the reality that they symbolize, and only in a secondary fashion as a matter of protection. The third is somewhat derivative, and that is the presence of amuletic objects as signs of recognition. For some centuries at least, members of secret fraternities and lodges would wear some symbols which identified them primarily to other members of such associations, and thereby they would be recognized. Probably the such symbols most frequently seen are those of modern Freemasonry, the most prominent of which being the square and the compass, which you see around here quite a bit. Now, Freemasons were, of course, present in Europe. That's where they came from. That's where they came to America from. And certainly there were Masons around, say, when I grew up as a child. But owing to the much more closely observed secrecy there, the Masonic emblems were heavily disguised. And so you would have a gentleman maybe with a very heavily ornamented keychain with one or two medals on it. And if you looked very, very close, then among all kinds of floral ornamentation or something like that, you could see the square and compasses, but you had to know. Along with grips and passwords and other things of that sort, these amuletic talismanic objects, certain ones, serve that purpose. Now, when we go back into classical antiquity, and that is really what we are interested in, because the particular engraved stones that we shall be observing shortly go back to what is often called late antiquity, or the latter part of the ancient world, the Alexandrian period. But in antiquity, particularly in the Roman Empire, it is rather well known that ornamental jewelry was almost always combined with mystical and magical properties. People seldom wore jewelry just as an adornment, but they wore it as an adornment and also for mystico-magical, for its mystico-magical properties. First of all, the most common of these ideas was always that the very stones themselves had special properties. For instance, I wear a rather large amethyst, as you know, but the original magical property, as it would have been recognized in the ancient world and then later on in the Renaissance also, that the amethyst is a defense against poisons, including drunkenness. For instance, they would put amethyst crystals into a chalice, into a goblet or whatever, and then pour wine over it. And that way you could drink a lot and you wouldn't get drunk, at least so they thought. I have found it to be very effective against getting drunk, primarily if one drinks little. But let's say in the same manner, all kinds of stones served as sort of reminders of prayers and invocations. In other words, you might look at your amulet and see the particular formulae, the particular barbarous words, the chants, the lettered there, and then you could chant them. Rather, the same principle as, let's say, using the beads of a rosary. It's a mnemonic device to remember certain prayers and incantations. So it is possible that people were reminded of what they were to recite or chant. It is not at all likely, in fact, that these devices were signs of recognition worn for identification to others. First of all, as far as we are able to determine, these stones were worn at the time when there was no persecution of Gnostics. So there was no need for secrecy. I think to sort of see these in a kind of Masonic light is largely the projection of 19th century writers who were Freemasons themselves and who thought people in the 3rd century followed the same customs as they did. Protective uses there may have been, but more in a derivative sense. Such as that good wards off evil, symbols of divine beings keep demons at bay, symbols of liberation control the archons. Another word, and then we will start looking at the stones. It may be good to say a few words in advance before we actually observe them concerning the symbolic figures on the stones. The majority have as their main or only figure the celebrated Gnostic mystical figure Abraxas or Abrasax. For this reason, the gems have been called generically Abraxoids, meaning Abraxas-like objects. Occasionally there are some other figures, most frequently, and we have one like that, we will see it, most frequently we find the late Egyptian, by which in the late Egyptian period, the Greco-Egyptian period, deity Harpocrates, a derivative of Horus, that's where the Har comes from, who is the god of secrecy and of the guardian of mysteries. He always holds his finger to his mouth. That's how you can see Harpocrates. Indicating keep the secret, and that is a rather good Gnostic admonition, because if as a Gnostic to tell people generally what you are into, the esteem in which you are held is not going to increase, it is likely to decrease, and so it's a good thing to keep one's counsel if one does this sort of thing. There are deeper meanings of it too. If you reveal in hearing of the archons that you are trying to get out of their claws, they are likely to dig their claws more deeply into your flesh or into your psyche, which is even more pernicious. So the Harpocrates sometimes accompanied by attendants, as we will see one. Abraxas, well, there are, before I come to Abraxas in conclusion, also at times we don't have one of those with us now, a serpent with a halo, which is the Nahas, the serpent of wisdom. Also at times a lion serpent, about which I may speak later on. These are the most popular figures. Abraxas we shall deal with, of course, in greater detail in the talk next week, but just very, very quickly, the figure of Abraxas is what the archaeologists and mythologists technically would call by the German name Mischwesen. That's they used in English too. A Mischwesen means a mixed being. A being, that is composed of many different elements. A sphinx would be a Mischwesen, for instance. But this one has the head of a bird, either a rooster or a hawk, depending on the design. Makes no difference. The torso and arms of a human, legs like snakes, most often holding a whip or flail and a shield. The garb seems to be that of a warrior, a military skirt, like they would be worn by soldiers of Rome, and a bare chest, or maybe occasionally even a breastplate. Sometimes Abraxas is shown as a charioteer, riding a chariot with four horses. Let's just say very quickly, as we will do in greater details at some point, that Abraxas, according to the latest researches mythologically, is a son of Sophia. He is the good Archon who has turned to the wisdom of his mother and who has been redeemed, and who therefore stands both as the symbol and the helper of redemption. He has been set above the planets, in the eighth region, above the seven planets, the ruler of the seventh heaven, because he has overcome the world. With his rooster eye, he awakens the sleepers. He may be also considered to be composed of the four elements, the bird standing for air, the man for earth, the snakes for water, and the life and the blood within the person for the fire. Thus he is also considered a union of the opposites. It was in that light that C.G. Jung saw him in his famous Seven Sermons to the Dead, where he devoted quite a bit of attention to him. I think that this will give us enough basic background at this point in order to be able to address ourselves to our designs with which we shall now proceed. Here, of course, we have seen the four, which have been loaned to us in their frontal view. Abraxas to the right, Abraxas to the left, Abraxas down below. These are all three of them are Abraxas, and the Harpocrates over there, and we will look at all of them in greater detail. And now I think we will go on with some of the others. This is merely one of the stones shown without the intaglio in it, just seeing what kind of material the stone is made of. And I think this is the stone of the ring of Mr. Manly Palmer Hall, without the inscription, just the stone. There, this is the design of Mr. Hall's ring, in the frontal view. To my knowledge, it was acquired by Manly Palmer Hall sometimes in the 1930s in Europe. At that time, it was considered an unusually large Abraxoid. But we will see that some of the ones that we have here exhibiting are very large also. It is of rather crude workmanship. It's very angular. But there is Abraxas. He holds the whip or flail and the shield, which one cannot see all that well, but it is there. And one cannot see an inscription on the shield in this case. The letters which usually accompany Abraxas, the letters E-R-O, there is the A, there is the O in a rather squarish look, and no doubt the I was somewhere over here, but we can't see it too well. As I say, this is not, certainly not as fine workmanship as some of the ones that we will see. But the essentials of the Abraxas are there. And this is certainly a rooster head rather than a hawk head, because it has a very straight beak, like chickens generally do. You can see his chest is always very muscular, and has strong biceps and strong muscles on his arms, just like a strong warrior would be. And the skirt of the soldier below the waist is there, and then you have the snake, the serpentine legs, which here are very very crudely executed. You can hardly tell that that's a head of a snake, but if you know what an Abraxas generally looks like, then you know what it is like. And with that, I think we can go on to one of the others. Now, this is the lovely Abraxas in amber, which was given to me, and which is my pride and joy. It's a translucent stone, and for this reason I have had it set in a reliquary, which has glass in the front and glass in the back, because that way you can hold it up to the light and then you can really see the intaglio very, very well. It is a typical Abraxas. The only possibly unique feature may be that the serpent legs are coiled, as you can see. In most of the others, they are not coiled like this. On the shield, you have the E-R-O. Again, these are capital Greek letters. Later on, when we find much more elaborate inscriptions, we will see that the language is Coptic rather than just Greek. And the usual rule of thumb is that everything that is written in the capital letters is in the nature of a magic out, which is certainly not uncommon with apes. But hair sticking out of him. You can see the hair coming out in all directions. Trying to figure out why Harpocrates or any other deity should have a baboon with him, at least it's my conviction, that's somewhat sustained by Wallace Budge and people of that sort, so that the baboon often indicated sort of the lower aspect of the god. Because after all, baboons and other monkeys are very humanoid. They look very much like a human, frighteningly so, but they ain't, as one might say in elegant language. There is the animal, the monkey side of us, the monkey mind, and the animal nature. And then there is the god itself. But you see, the animal nature is subservient to the higher nature. The god sits on a throne. The monkey just stands on a kind of a little earth platform, and it could be conceivably the symbol of the lesser, the natural, the animal human serving the greater human, who knows the mystery and who bids everyone to be silent about the mystery. There are inscriptions around, from left to right, I am reading what I deciphered, if I was right, again. I-E-I-O-U-E-O-E-A-O-E-A-O-I. That's the first one then. I-E-U-E-U-E-O-O-A-S-A-L-A-E-E. Near where the chip is another one which is probably and a Coptic letter which is something like ps. We will see his reverse side in a minute, in the really the most spectacular piece, of course, will be last in this shortly to come. But now we'll look probably at the reverse. There is the reverse side of chip. There are only inscriptions. Usually there are only letters on the reverse side. A, I, A, O, T, E, Tu, Ri, E, Te, To, O, Na, a number of other ones coming down. Again, a magical sentence. And then we will come now to the last and the biggest and the most beautiful of the lot. There he is, front side. In our jocular manner, because of his size and all that, we have referred to this one as Big Mama. So there is Big Mama, obviously on Abraxas, very, very well executed. I don't know whether we probably have another one where we can see the details better, but it's you can. There you are. I mean, look how clear and how beautifully executed this is. It's an unusually beautiful carving job. He holds undoubtedly the flail. It's a little smaller, or maybe the end of it is chipped off. And then the shield. The shield has on it Iao Sabaoth, the complete one. The right hand is raised, holding the flail. Below him is a design which is interpreted by some scholars as a wheel, and it may very well be. But if it indeed is a wheel, it is a wheel with 8 spokes, rather like the wheel of the Dharma in Buddhism, and it may signify a chariot. Instead of putting the whole chariot on which he rides, they just put a wheel. But it may also, in addition to that, or in lieu of, since it has 8 spokes, it may indicate the Ogdoad, that he is in the seventh sphere. To his left is an interesting magical sequence. It starts out A-E-I-O-U-O-E, right? Over there. Then the A drops off, and it's just A-E-I-O-U-E. And then it A-E-O-U-O, and it becomes less E-O-U-O-U-O, and finally on the bottom just O. So it's always one letter drops off and it diminishes, although there's one little glitch there in the middle. But it's one of these magical sequences where you have only one letter at the bottom, in this case the omega, and then it expands and finally becomes the whole sentence. I-A-E-O-U-O-A. No, I-O-U-O. I-O-U-O. The end is an omega. You observe the inscription on the rim, which is quite... There are inscriptions over here too, and then there are many more on the reverse side. And again, the the inscriptions are various magical words, but I think we still have the reverse side to look at. But look at that wonderfully executed piece. This looks incidentally more like the head of a hawk. You can see the beak is curved. It's the hawk's beak rather than that straight chicken beak. But there is some sort of an ornament on his head that really could be more like the comb of a rooster. So it's both. It even has the indication of a kind of a robe, a fabric falling down from his shoulder, and then again he has the military skirt, very nicely carved chest and abdominal area, and even the loop on the shield through which he puts his arm. So it's really very, very detailed, and the snakes are quite impressive too, and there is no mistaking them that they are snakes. And then we'll go on to the reverse side of this, and then we shall be finished. Well, this gives you an indication again of the color of the stone, of what kind of stone it is carved into, what it looks like, and you see it's you can see, of course it's not that thick, but you can see that this is quite a thick stone, and it has that greenish color mottled with other materials. I don't know whether I have a note as to what kind of stone this one is made out of, but it's certainly it's a very, very fine stone with very, very beautiful carving. And I think we'll probably have a clearer one. There we are with a clearer one of the reverse side. And here in the midst of several magical words that have Z in it, which is a favorite one in some of the Gnostic mantras, like Zoa, 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 Zoe, Zao, Zoa, and things of that sort, sort of a buzzing sound. We then have a number of once again we have a sort of a wheel-like symbol. 1, 2, 3, 4. For that one, 6. Something over there that seems like a fourfold symbol, and then we have definitely an eightfold symbol with the moon to one side, probably indicating the Ogdoad. Undoubtedly, all of these were quite meaningful to the people who saw them. They knew what they were, and they knew how to use these in order to recite the various invocations. Even if the carver made a mistake and maybe put in an extra letter or left one out, they knew what it meant. And so these are really iconographical and prayerful symbols. So I think that brings us to the conclusion of these. This is about the time when we usually conclude anyway. And I think I will just thank you for your attention and hope that these have been of interest to you. And then we'll go from there. And we'll conclude this part. See, there again are the four, is the family of the four, 3 Abraxases and 1 Harpocrates, in a very nice carvings. So thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed this. And also please give a hand, and I certainly express my thanks not only to our kind and wonderful friend who let us borrow these wonderful things, which cost a great deal of money and are very valuable, but also to my friend Brian Campbell, who has so expertly and with so much work arranged this whole show. And I think we really appreciate that.
Copyright MMI by BC Recordings, catalog number 100905. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.